I don't know how you feel about sex in the morning. somebody was quoting me. I just, when I walked by, they said that the announcement was that Elmer was going to talk about sexuality in Koinonia. I thought I'd talk about it anyplace. I wrote a book a long time ago that sold a lot of copies. It's called Life Can Be Sexual. It's a bad title, but it was purposely put that way because it was at a time when the church wasn't too sure that it is sexual. But my wife always wanted to do a sequel to that book. Life Can Be Sexual, and her book was going to be But Don't Count On It. There's a fellow who comes up here every once in a while who was a campus pastor. I think he's now retired, called Ron Burke. And he wrote up a list of odd-looking names for Lutheran churches. These are actually found in the yearbooks. You can look them up yourself if you want. And he made a whole list of them. I thought they were terribly interesting. Some of them were almost depressing, but some of them were sort of exciting, too. There's one entitled Soldier Lutheran Church in Soldier, Iowa. Anybody know? Yeah. Soldier, Iowa. Okay. There's a Peerless Lutheran Church. I thought that was a little pride there. Peerless, Montana, that is. I think this one's more accurate. Hazard Lutheran Church in Hazard, Nebraska. How about this one? Cold Water Lutheran Church. You guys know that in Concord, North Carolina? Now there's Dinky Memorial. I think that's marvelous. That's in Asheville, Pennsylvania.
They can't hear you.
Oh, okay. See if I stand up, it'll work better. And I'll move back so it's obvious.
Pardon?
That's just recording, not application. Okay, so the other Lutheran church is Huff's Lutheran Church. I like that one, too. Old Goschenhopen. Just to spell it, you get in to be members. If you don't spell it, you're just... And there's Sinking Springs Lutheran Church. But the ones that really bothered me that made me wonder about what's going on in the Lutheran Church and relates to our topic today... There's an Eager Lutheran Church, a Fertile Lutheran Church, a Climax Lutheran Church, and a Bang Lutheran Church. I don't know where we got it. I purposely started out with humor. And because it reminds me of a quotation now at the moment I was looking in there to see if I had it written down, who said it. And he said, I lose respect for the person who can laugh at coarse or other sexual humor, but become silent when serious discussion of sexuality takes place. So if you are willing to laugh, then I assume you're going to be willing to participate in the discussion as well. Because I think that's been one of the failures of both the church and a lot of church people, is that they have been terribly, terribly silent about sexuality. In a moment I'll be talking about how I make a difference between sex and sexuality, just for purposes of talking. But I thought I'd involve you in some discussion first, if you don't mind, by telling you a story. How many of you have heard the Alligator River story? Probably some have. You have. Okay, well, let's try the Alligator River story. Let's tell the story about a woman named Anne and a man named Bob who lived on opposite sides of a river. They fell in love with each other. And they truly enjoyed their relationship. And Anne would come across to see Bob, and Bob would come across to see Anne. It was just a marvelous, marvelous kind of relationship. And one spring, there was a terrible flood that came down and wiped out the bridge. And it was a good-sized river. So there was no way of getting back and forth, and there's no other bridge for miles and miles around. So Anne is trying to figure out what to do. Bob is trying to figure out what to do. And Anne goes and sees her friend Charles and explains to her all the problems that she's facing and that she would like to be able to get across the river. And Charles says, I don't want to be bothered about it. So she goes and sees a man down here near the bridge whose name is David. Because David has a boat. And he explains her problem to David and asks David if he would take her across the river. And in true, so often male form, he said, sure, if you go to bed with me. So Anne went back up to Charles and explained what had happened with David. And Charles still said, don't bother me, I'm not interested. So Anne stewed for a while and finally agreed to go across the river with David. Went to bed with him, and he took her across the river. And she had a great reunion with Bob on the other side of the river. And then she told Bob what she had done to get across the river. And Bob dumps her off of his lap, tells her he doesn't want to see her ever again, and goes off into the woods because he's so angry. And there, a fellow named Ed comes walking along and asks Bob what he's doing, because he's obviously so angry. And Ed hears the story of what's all gone on, and Bob says he is really angry at this woman for what she did. And Ed gets so disturbed about Bob that he beats up Bob for what he had done. That's the end of the story. Now the assignment. I want you to, the alligator, this the river was filled with. The assignment is for you.
The river.
Pardon?
How did Anne get back across the river?
Don't know. She may still be over there. Here's the assignment. List the people by name, the five names. You might notice they're A, B, C, D, E. By number, the first one being least offensive to you, and number five being most offensive to you. Okay? Take the five names, and in your mind, you don't have to write them down, you do it yourself. Which one is most offensive of those five characters? Which one is least offensive? Listed from the least offensive first down to the most offensive for last.
Charles.
No, don't yell them out. Just do it for yourself, and we'll just find out what the people have done. We'll give you a moment to think about that. So you can get them organized for yourself.
Got a questionnaire.
Pardon? Oh, yeah, right. There's a place over here if you want. All right, you got yours picked out. Let me just ask by a show of hands. How many of you picked Anne as least offensive? Pull up your hand if you did. How many of you picked Bob as least offensive? How many of you picked Charles as least offensive? How many of you picked David as least offensive?
He's a rascal.
He's a rascal.
And how many of you picked Ed as least offensive? Okay. How many of you picked Anne as most offensive? All right. How many of you picked Bob as most offensive? How many of you picked Charles as most offensive? Okay. How about if you pick David as most offensive? And how many of you picked Ed as most offensive? Okay, that's interesting. Okay, what do you think each of these represents? These people. What do you think each person represents in the story?
Their character.
Well, what would you say? What is the character of each one? Let's start with Ed. What's the character of Ed?
He's a holy righteous type.
Vigilante. Right? He didn't have any right to beat anybody up. He wasn't a law enforcement person at all. He just went ahead and beat somebody up. That guy scares me. What's David? What does David stand for?
He's
the
rascal.
Exploiter. Oh, no, excuse me. I meant Charles.
Indifferent.
Apathy.
Not going to get involved in any way.
Right. You like that?
No.
All right. How about David?
Utilitarian.
This is bad.
Pardon?
We can make a business deal.
Businessman.
Most honest.
He did what he said. He didn't have to take her across the river. Right? He kept his bargain. I'm not saying he's good, I'm just saying he did keep his bargain. He made a deal, he kept his deal.
He's an opportunist.
Materialist, an opportunist, whatever you want to say. Okay. And how about Bob?
Unforgiving.
Judgmental. No
pity. Judgmental?
He's a victor, right for a
My question is, why did Bob try to get over the river, too?
That's the usual question. We put him in the best light, you can say there was no boat on the other side. But that's the story, just comes that way. That's one of the problems. Pardon?
He wasn't going to grandmother's house, that's why he didn't go across the river.
It may be. Okay, how about Anne? What's she stand for? What does she symbolize? Infatuation. Is that how you feel about it? She's aggressive.
She cared about Bob.
What?
She cared about Bob.
She cared about Bob.
She talked to him.
Talked to
him. She got victimized. Just poor judgment.
She got a value. Okay, I'm trying to get at what she symbolized. Well, I'm not asking what she did. You're saying what she did. What does that symbolize? Okay, well, maybe if you hold up your hand and we'll each get you to say it then, because I'm getting double messengers not hearing people. What do you think she symbolizes?
Determination.
Pardon?
Determination.
Determination, okay.
Sacrifice.
Weakness.
Ingenuity.
Certainly situational, right? Wouldn't you say that? Because at first she said no, and then looked at the situation and did something else. So she evaluated the situation too. She was more situational than some of the other characters in that. The reason for telling a story like that and getting you to respond is mostly to make it clear how difficult it is to be absolute about anything. Most of you would not have the same list, I'm sure. Certainly not everybody in the room would have them in the same way. We might say everybody there was in the wrong in some way. But some people were more in the wrong or more in the right, depending on your views and your values as they relate to the faith. And talking about that reveals for us, for most of us, as we look at ourselves, if we're willing to do that, you know, what are our values when it comes to sexuality? Now, let me spend a little time here just saying, but I'm going to use the word sex and sexuality in different ways. I'm going to try. I don't always accomplish this. When I talk about sex, I'm going to be talking about genital activity. Intercourse, in the broad sense of that word, the connection between people is taking place in its genital activity. And I'm going to use the word sexuality to mean the fact that we are sexual beings, whether or not there's any genital activity or not. Now that's pretty broadly accepted in many places today, but it all took place within the last 30 years. It's really Mary Calderon was the one who developed these ways of talking about it, and she's still living in New York City. I think the very helpful ways of remembering that we are all sexual beings. We'll say some more about that. And all that means that being female or being male means to you is your sexuality. Or another way of putting it, your self-understanding as a male or a female person. That's your sexuality. Part of that is how you express yourself genitally. But what we have done is made sex only that, and that's only a part of it, and I think that's been very harmful to us in our understanding and thinking. Or what you communicate to another person as a male or a female person. I am a sexual person communicating to you. I'm not standing here or sitting here thinking about being male or anything, but all that is in me and my self-understanding as a male is being used just normally in communicating to you. So in this sense, you know, here's where you get into all the trouble about the laughing again. This is a sexual relationship. It's not what I would call a sex relationship, but it's a sexual relationship. And so all of our relationships have that dimension to it. Now, that is not saying everything is sex by any means, nor it is saying that everything is sexual in the sense that that's the focus of it. You go batty just as you will as you get on any hobby horse if you thought that way. But there is a sexual dimension to all that we do, and that's the point that I wanted to make clear. So all relationships are sexual. And helping ourselves to understand that, it seems to me, is an important part. I'll just do a few more parts of this as presentation and then stop for your questions and comments, okay? The church, I think, historically, and there are others who think the same way, and this is one of the things you can disagree with later on, I think the church historically has been wrong about women and about sex and sexuality. I think that it has been taught very, very badly. And all you have to do is go back and examine some of the things that were taught. I remember specifically, I think I still have the book, where I was taught at seminary 400 or 500 years ago, we would warn our people about association with prostitutes and actors and actresses. They're all in the same category. They taught it. They printed it. They taught it in class. Church has been often, most of the time, I think, very, very wrong. You and I were taught about sexuality or sex, if at all, from the point of view of the church, even if it was by silence, by people who were trained in Europe during the Pietistic years. Just take it back, huh? Two generations for some of us, maybe three for another, and the people who taught you were trained in a very, very super pious movement in Europe and brought to us here. Now there are others that have been trained differently, but I think most Lutherans have that kind of a heritage. And that's something to be aware of. And it wasn't that many people broke out of that kind of background and training. I'm not saying everything that was said was wrong, But I think that the approach to it was very, very narrow and often very, very wrong and often biblically unsound, in which it made the body evil and made in an effort to make the spirit good. And when God talks about the validness of being your bodies being the temple of the Holy Spirit, we're in trouble when we make the body evil. What we can do with anything, all good things can be abused, and certainly sexuality has been abused. There's no question about it. But so has money, and so have cars, and so have insurance policies, and so have whatever in the world, without really ending up saying then, as often the church had said, implied, sometimes taught implied, that the body, the functions of the body, were evil. And therefore also being a sexual being was evil. How did the church handle it? There are three ways I think that the church tried to do this. First, it tried, I don't know about in sequence, but one of the ways it tried is to control it by reason and will. If you get enough education, then people will all be able to do this or that. And I think we found out clearly enough that that wouldn't do it. Well, we've tried that for a couple of centuries now, maybe, at least for a good number of generations. And it just didn't work. The second thing is the church tried to teach that self-control can work that, can work, but what it did was led into this teaching of the body being evil. And so you had to deny your body. Often with that came denial of your identity as a person. A large part of what people say today is still the identity crisis, and I think especially among women, where they feel they aren't worth anything unless they're doing something, they have no worth in themselves, has its history in the teaching about sexuality, although it wasn't ever organized under that category, in saying that the body is not worthwhile. And if the body was the main function of the woman as a mother, it got the impression, subtly, that the women were not worthwhile, and only the one who is out producing something or whatever it may be. And the third thing I think that the church did over a long period of time is say that sex is unimportant. Now, it was terribly important to everybody around, including the leaders of the church, if you read your history. And certainly to the membership, otherwise all those children wouldn't be born all through the years. But the church wanted to say, well, that's really not important and we don't want to deal with it. And for long periods of time, it did not. The book I referred to earlier was part of the Concordia Sex Education series published in 1967. I think I wrote the book in 65. And that was the first, according to what people told me, the first church-sponsored sex education series that had been done in any denomination up to that time in this country. So you see how recent getting things out in the open to talk about sexuality is. So it's really much more recent. And of course, the biblical concept of the incarnation, where Jesus chooses the body, God chooses to send Jesus into a body, that's what incarnation is all about, is so at odds with the putting down of the human body. We were taught about sexuality under the sixth commandment when I was back there. It was always, thou shalt not commit adultery. That's how you talked about it. When I caught on, in my confirmation class, I never did that. I did it under the creed under Jesus Christ. I would ask the kids where Jesus was 500 years before he was born. Or how many years or wherever it is, and then 3 months before he was born. That he chose, as far as we know and believe, to come via Mary. And was inside of her body and chose that, if you will, sexual route to come to the world. That gives it a whole different pitch, it seems to me, than starting with the sixth commandment which talks about abusing the gift of sex that you have been given. So, no way am I talking about taking this not seriously, the possibility of abuse, but I wrote some things where I thought the connections were made between sexuality and the faith. And let me just read you these seven things. Wrote this a long time ago, and I agree with some of it yet today. You know, I don't. Most things I write, I don't agree with next week. But so these are the things I offered for discussion in the book I wrote. As Christians, we are called to see sexuality as a God-given and God-redeemed way of relating to people. Remember, I'm talking about sexuality now, not sex, right? We got that difference. Christ redeemed our total being, body, soul, mind, emotions, and desires. He rules over earthly matter and human processes, including our sexual relationships. Secondly, as Christians, we're called to an understanding of sexuality that begins with our view of our own selves, the value we place on ourselves as persons, for whom Christ died and in whom God lives. Usually our acceptance of others depends on our acceptance of ourselves for any sexual relationship. Thirdly, as Christians, we are called to recognize the sexual dimensions of all of our relationships with others and work at seeing all persons in God's perspective. We learn that what happens to persons is what counts. To love means to seek the best for others in our relationships with them. And fourth, as Christians, we affirm the spontaneity of our sexuality. Our relationships are free rather than forced. They happen. A tree bears flowers and fruit without instruction or command. To love means to be free to respond. God's love frees our sexuality to bring about His kind of love in the everyday, extraordinary, frustrating, exciting situations of life. Five. As Christians, we are called to take seriously God's particular concerns, directions, and limitations for expressing our sexuality. This especially involves sexual intercourse, marriage, and the reproduction of children. Six, as Christians, we are called to affirm the joy of God's forgiveness of our misuse of our sexuality. We are aware of our neglect to love as fully as we're able. We know we often twist our sexuality from love into lust. But God conquered lust and paid the price for sin. In God's Son, we are made alive again sexually. By the way, the editors of the book wanted to delete the word sexually at that point. Fortunately, I had copyrighted my manuscript before I sent it in, and they couldn't take that word out. I think the book didn't make sense if you took that word out. But that's where the editors were at that time. And finally, as Christians, we recognize God as the source of practical, personal power to guide and control, direct our sexuality. The promise of God's Spirit as the one who stands with us is constant and clear. What God makes, God services. So maybe just threw us out there without any power. That's an antidote to what a lot of people say. I think especially men historically, well, I have this sex drive and I just can't control it. I think that's unadulterated bull. There's not even any conviction on the part of the scholars and or the research scientists that there might even be such a thing as sex drive. It may be all learned anyway. We're not even sure about that. So to go off and say, I have no control over it or something like that, or God gave it to me. God, what God gives, God services, and God makes it possible for us to be in charge of it. And as I said in there too, God forgives the abuse for sure, but he doesn't design it for abuse by any way. Well, I became intrigued when I read something by Carl Jung. I'm not a Jungian, but Jung wrote, when people bring sexual questions to him, they invariably turned out to be religious questions. And when they brought religious questions to him, they always turned out to be sexual questions. I think that's terribly intriguing. You might want to figure that out sometime. I'm not sure that I can figure it out, but I think it's a very interesting part of one. I've got an elaborate section of how I think there is a theology of sexuality, but I'd rather go on to another part that I want to share with you right here. That I think that there are things that could guide our people to think about and talk about and to teach. A good number of you now are in the process of we're expressing your sexuality might be more an exercise in memory, but I hope not. I've done presentations on this to many homes for the elderly, for the staff, because the staff had little understanding of the sexual needs of the people who were in these elderly homes. So I'm just kidding about the memory part. But the part that is important is, how do we ever change some understanding so there's a connection between expressing your sexuality, including sexual intercourse, and the Christian faith? Most people, you know, have those things so separated it's impossible to pull them together. That even to talk about sex in church is considered a really crazy thing. An important part of almost every human being's life, and yet you're not supposed to talk about it related to the faith. That's terrible tragedy. So I think getting folks comfortable with understanding ways, and I don't think there are any perfect ways of doing this, to talk about it so that we can begin to change both attitudes and understanding, and by God's grace, power to reshape the attitudes towards the way we express our sexuality. And I think that's what the church is about today, and most of that is done by parents. The choice of who's going to do it. And all parents do it by either saying nothing, or saying too much, or certainly by the way they view themselves as sexual beings. So here are some values that I think are important to be involved in passing on attitudes towards sex, human sexuality, so that guides the way people express that sexuality. And by the way, I hope you understand that I'm telling you, in a class that I used to teach, we'd list 80, 90 ways to express your sexuality. I mean, part of that was intercourse and genital activity, but there's just loads of other ways that you express who you are as a sexual being. As we were saying before, almost everything you do. But remembering somebody's birthday is a sexual expression. Bringing somebody a flower is. And our society and our advertising industry has just made genital activity the focus of all sexual expression. And we are impoverished because of that it has to be only genital sex that it allows you to express yourself as a sexual person. That's another great, great tragedy. You take sex of that kind, sex, out of the advertising industry, what do you think? The economy 3 weeks would go? 3 weeks maybe? Six? It would go. The current one would, seems to me. And I'm not blaming them. They're only doing it because people are buying. So I'm talking about us, and they are part of us. Here are some of the things that I think are worth looking at as values. I think that expressions of our human sexuality ought to be self-liberating. They ought to be a way for getting outside of ourselves, because that's what we're meant for. There is an internal side of us, it's very important, but another part of us is just our whole relationship to whatever's going around. And that ought to be part of the goal, one of the goals that we have. Our expressions of human sexuality ought to be other enriching. Other enriching. In other words, that it's designed for the other person to be more than he or she was prior to that. The goal of love for another person, to be, make that person other enriching. It ought to be honest, and there's where we are so fooled most of the time. Now, I think original sin was self-deception. When I was at the university that I talked about yesterday, Governor State University, I couldn't use the words of the church because everybody was anti-church or ex-church. And people, sin was bad. One of the worst words was servant. Would not accept the word servant at all. So I'd have to find other words. And when I wanted to talk about this, about sin, things going wrong, I'd just say to the person, well, how about deception? Have you ever been deceived by anybody? Well, yeah. Have you ever deceived yourself? Yeah. So I think that's what it's about. And here in this area of being honest, we are most vulnerable to deceiving ourselves. And again, as I said before, the society tends, our history tends to help us deceive ourselves, that we have great difficulty, I think, being honest both about our feelings and about our ways of expressing those feelings, especially through human sexuality. I think that also another one is a value is that we ought to be faithful, that we ought to be characterized by a consistent pattern of interest and concern for the people we express ourselves to sexually, whether that is in parenting or in friendship or in business associations, or in our spouse, that it ought to be one of faithfulness, an ongoing one. When I talk to single young adults, as I do, and I will, I think, a couple weeks from Saturday, once again, over in Spokane, about things like this, the word commitment is a really tough one for many young adults to deal with, single young adults I'm talking about. So in talking about faithfulness, I use the illustration, and I say it to you so you can have some reaction to it if you want. And that is that I think that faithfulness is not limited to genital activity. The entrance of a penis into a vagina, whether or not that has happened, isn't the only thing by any means that defines faithfulness. My illustration would be that if there's a spouse lying in bed next to his wife or her husband, and that spouse does not really care, but has never been with anybody else, but doesn't really care about the physical, spiritual, emotional, and any other development of that person, that spouse is guilty of infidelity. And that spouse ought to be as easily pointed at as when somebody goes to bed with somebody else. I'm not saying one is good or bad, better or worse, but not to be committed to the other person is to be unfaithful, whether or not anybody has been to bed. And we have focused, again, because of our preoccupation with genital sex, that the only way you can be unfaithful is to be in bed with somebody else. I'm saying, most of the time, I believe that is unfaithfulness. I'm not trying to play that down. But I think we've been tricked into thinking about that at the expense of infidelity, which leads to, I think, to many more problems in marriage and probably in divorces that doesn't have to do necessarily, or may later on lead to some genital sex activity when, first of all, it was a loss of faithfulness in the first place. I think that another value for expressing our human sexuality is that it ought to be socially responsible. This business of anything that two consenting adults do, I think, is a bunch of malarkey. In my counseling, I've picked up too many single adults, later on, who were terribly consenting at the time and who were terribly hurt later on. It is not a personal thing in the sense that it doesn't affect anybody else, just as marriage does, or having children, or whatever it is. Those are societal things. They do affect us one way or another. And the society ought to be a responsible thing. So just to get into our little cocoon and say, well, I do what I want to do, is, first of all, irresponsible, and I think terribly unchristian, because the Christian is called to be a part of the society and to enrich and enliven the society, and we ought not let people get away with that kind of thing. Then I think that the value is that the expression, all expressions of sexuality ought to be life-serving. It ought to engender livingness. I don't mean only engender a child, a reproductive process, but livingness in the people that are participating in that. And finally, I think that one of the values in expressing human sexuality is that it ought to be joyous. It ought to be joyous. That it was meant for celebration as well. It's interesting, when we got into the classes that I taught, we would give a list of the meaning of sexual intercourse, the meanings that we give to sexual intercourse. We talk sometimes about doing it, the it. It became quite clear in those discussions that the men and the women often had different meanings that they were giving to it, and that the meanings before, during, and after were different. So you might have six meanings at least going to any it that is performed. So we really do a lot of harm by just talking about it, because there's lots of meanings that we are giving to it. One last comment, this next one is usually a whole hour lecture. I think the basis for good expression of ourselves as human personalities to one another is friendship in a very deep sense of the word, physical connections, presence with one another, and that includes the possibility of touch and of hug, and in committed situations for sexual intercourse, and finally also commitment to that other person. I put a heavy load on what it means to be a friend, however. That includes mutuality and trust and openness and risk and gentleness. And I think all five of those are found in how God expresses God's self to us by choosing to be mutual with us. Jesus says in John 15, I have told you all that I have received from the Father. That's a fantastic text. That's why I no longer call you servants, but I call you friends. God chooses to be mutual with us. God trusts us. I wouldn't trust us. Look how we can mess things up, huh? Doesn't take long. Whatever it may be. And God still trusts us. God is open and honest with us. He tells us more than we can even understand. He warns us. He promises us. God is so vulnerable to us. Not only in the death of Christ, but in all the promises as well. And God risks with us, not only this universe, but God's own livelihood, sending his Son into this world. You know what he did about other worlds, but this one he certainly risked on. And God comes gently to us. He didn't come slam bang and knock everything down. little kid in Mary's arms. Luther said, look at him. He's there, he's sucking his mother's breast. You scared of God? There's your Lord, your Savior, a little child. Not powerless. Gentleness usually means that you are strong. Only the strong can afford to be gentle. And if, as I believe, in our society, not congenitally, but in our society, the women are most able to express gentleness, and men are have more difficulty in expressing gentleness, then it says to us, it seems to me, that the strong in this society are the women. And that means that the men, we who are men, ought to be learning from women how to be gentle. I don't mean the feminization of men. I mean learning gentleness. And of course, what's more difficult is the women have to be willing to teach us. I think I'll stop there. Some time for discussion, questions.
What about the issue of premarital sex?
Okay. How do you feel about it?
The reason I'm asking is because they would have asked it before I came, and that he was very concerned about young people and premarital sex and sexual activity of 6th and 7th graders. I think it also includes older people.
Oh, I do too. My view is that it is destructive in most cases because it doesn't include the values that we're talking about. Often it's born of a society which just says that's a thing to do, really a thing to do. Now I think again, self-deception works. People are always deceiving themselves that, oh, we're deeply in love, da da da, and all that kind of stuff. I think that's rarely possible to be true. Now we know that, and the church teaches, and I think rightly on this, it isn't the ceremony that makes you married. A lot of people say that when they get in their teens and things like that, but it isn't intercourse that makes you married either. It's the commitment to one another and understanding of it. And this whole worshiping of the younger generation, I think much of the younger generation is terribly boring, including their music. But you're not afraid to say that. But that doesn't mean they can't enjoy it if they want to. But I can't worship at the shrine of adolescence. And I spent 14 years in youth ministry, and they're as obviously as mixed up and if you will, I don't ever use this word, defouled, as anybody is. That doesn't mean more so. And I'm not just joining in a bunch of people who are past 32 here and saying that. I think there are plenty of people befouled who are in their older years too. But I think it's deception. But I think it's terribly difficult in this society not to be deceived. Because parents, church, lots of other people have been silent or afraid to say anything positive. We get people up here who said, I've never seen a happily married couple. That's plain bull. Now, maybe that person doesn't know what to look for, but it also may be that we're too reticent to talk about being happily married. All the jokes are about the trouble we have, right? Oh, well, she does this and he does that, and even when we're kidding. How do we communicate the unity of that? Jen and I were married 35 and a half years, we were married only as you can be married, and that is in a way that isn't perfect. 35 years of imperfect marriage, the only kind you can get. Having said that, then you can talk about the joys and all the rest of the stuff that are involved in that kind of commitment. I'd hate to have to have gone through Jenny's death without that commitment. I'd hate for her to have gone through that death without that commitment. You can't buy that. You don't order it from Spiegel's. It's a gift of God. So I think part of our failure has been our lack of openness in sharing some of that stuff. And the great battle, I have a lot of sympathy for with the young people in their struggle to live Christian values in this society. That's tough. But I don't think, just beat our breasts about it. I think we have to be willing to do something about it, because it certainly won't get better by itself. Somebody else?
Is our society going in the right direction? Because, like these young kids, they're really experimenting.
Where did they learn?
What did they hear? Their home environment.
Movies and TV. It's all terrible. We watch TV, the young people, glued to the TV, what do they see? Partners jumping in bed with everybody, it's just a common thing.
How many people here watch the soaps?
I used to.
I didn't think I was going to get any biters out of it. I didn't mind on that. I'd be amazed, though, how many Lutherans watch soaps. And so, I think there's a good way to do is you turn off the TV. When kids are young, you teach them how to turn off the TV.
Not when they get to be 14 and 16 years old.
I would. You bet your life I would. They'd get it themselves somewhere else. They wouldn't get it my place. Again, that's worshiping at the shrine. I wouldn't worship at the shrine of adolescence at all. And it's very, you don't get a lot, but you get something for selling your TV. We don't miss it up here one bit. We don't miss it up here one bit. No problem. But if the parents aren't willing to say no, it's going to go.
Sometimes if one parent says, turn off the TV, it's terrible. The other parent says, hey, it's okay. She likes to watch it, or she likes to watch it.
Yeah, there certainly will be no unanimity.
No.
Christianity is a counterculture. We can't accept that. We want to be nice in this culture. If we're really Christian, we are counterculture. We're going to be opposed to lots of things in this society. Your kids are going to be told you do things or don't do things at this house that other people do all the time or don't do all the time. They have to be counterculture. That's that movement that went in the 50s was right on with its basic concept, not the way it tried to live it out. But we are not Americans in that sense at all. Because Americans are just out to get a buck. That's what we're about. We're known for it. And to make a lot of improvements and everything in the process. But we are Christians who are worried about getting a buck because we know that the buck can deceive us. Doesn't always, but it can. And so we worry about it. And therefore we can take stands that are unpopular, whether that's on materialism, consumerism, or whatever it may be. I was amazed. My daughter just died. I didn't know. She was, quote, counterculture, but she had a charge account at the Bond in Seattle, which is one of the big stores. I was really amazed that she had that. But it was one of her inconsistencies that she felt all the consumerism was leading us down a primrose path. But when I paid her bill last week, which was a surprise to me. But yeah, go ahead.
I wish in this room though that we could go out with one concept and me being a parent of teenagers. We as the church have really made our teenagers all of them. And every time you talk about sex and immorality, you point at our young people. And I want to accept the responsibility of the parent that we have taught them. My daughter came home twice this summer crying. She played with a boy, and I knew exactly why she was crying. There was sex pressure. And we've had very open we'll talk for hours, and she loved to talk from 12 to 1.
Yeah.
And I was amazed at her conviction, and I want to take part of that credit as a parent, because we, being a Phi Ed teacher and teaching sex with young people, and she has grounds that I'm amazed at, that there will absolutely in her life be no sex before marriage. It floored me. It brought tears to my eyes. And we in this room need to go out and start sharing. I like the word sexuality, because then sex becomes part of our lives, and it has a meaning and a purpose. And it really hurts me deeply to put down teenagers, and we do it. And it's, I'm telling you, I've been called every word from my teenager, because my daughter's about as high strung as I am in her values. And we've had clashes. She's actually said, I hate you. I can't wait till I can graduate and get out of here. And then she was gone with the office and fired for 5 weeks, and she's been home for homestead. And that told me I'm happy. We need to embrace our young people so they can accept our values. And I share with our teenagers that I have the same pressures that you have in society, because I don't like to drink. And that was really a battle, to have friends who don't want to smoke or drink. That's my pressure. And they need to know that their pressures are no different than ours. We need to grow and help one another. And that's my God is Lord is so great. He gives me that daily strength to meet all him and I.
Thank you. Somebody else?
I taught school for a long time, and I feel that our problem with the teenagers and the problems the teenagers have start in the elementary school and even younger. The parents have one concern, that is to go and do their thing instead of being with their children and doing things with their children. And I know the class that I had this last year had so many, many problems with this. I delved into the problem. It came from homes where the parents were gone all the time. And those children I taught they were expected to babysit younger brothers and sisters instead of having parents there to do that.
It still depends on what you do when you're there. I had a family three doors down. They spent time together all the time. That was the most messed up family I ever found. Because the quality of what you do still counts. You're right.
I got one more comment that I'd like to share. And you as grandparents in this room, if you are grandparents, if you aren't, being adopted grandparents, we've moved and we're gone from our grandparents, so our children have absolutely no contact with the grandparents. We've adopted some, and the value that you can ingrain in our children is much more effective than we can, because mom and dad are so dumb. You know, we don't know anything right now. I can relate to that. But you are experts to them, and you're an outsider. I seek out adults to talk to my children, because I know they're going to say the same thing publicly I am saying, but they will respect you and not me. You have a task out there that is unlimited. Get in the bandwagon and have fun.
It's one of the things of coming here during the summer. We came here for 19 or 20 times with our family. And the surrogate parents that our kids had while they were here, we saw our kids every Thursday night for the evening meal, just to be sure they were still in the village. We all sat together that evening, because they came in at different times then. But they were often with other adults, young and older adults, got much information, and much of the good that they have been given from Holden came from those surrogate parents, not necessarily the teaching sessions or whatever it may be, and for the worship experiences here as well. So that's another way that that this place serves as for this surrogate parenting. It's not a long-term one, it's short-term.
This media anymore is so saturated with problems and concerns regarding AIDS and other sexual diseases and unwed, unplanned, unwanted pregnancies and so forth. And invariably, they are saying, the answer to all of this problem and concern is education. I disagree strongly as I think of the saying that says, he who learns and learns, but acts not what he knows, is like one who plows and plows, but never sows. Mm-hmm. You can know everything, but if you don't act on it, so what?
That's for sure. I think the church hasn't done its good job of teaching in this area, but it's no good unless it is followed with it. And again, I'll say my observing, I've been in the ministry 40 years now, of observing young people is no matter how you slice it, it's the parents. The only reason they go into therapy later on is because they're dealing with their parents. Their parents influence them deeply. And they may disagree with whatever it is too, but they still have to deal with it. So parenting is a terribly crucial part of it. Even though all these other things are bombarding them, they seldom go into therapy because they saw some program on TV. But they do go into therapy because they're at odds with their parents. And so our role as parents, or the role of grandparenting, is a terribly, terribly important one. Again, and that's going to be worked out differently in every family situation. But I can't underestimate what parents, what power parents have, even though they often don't feel that they do. And often feel they have anything but. And I mean power in the best sense. I don't mean power to make them sit down or make them do this, that, but I mean power of influencing them, and I would hope with the Christian perspective. Somebody else?
Well, they're really making big money on this sex thing now. There's Donna who practices here every morning, and the radio, and Dr. Ruth, and the radio's full of these amazing questions that they call it, and the answers those girls get. So I've decided that certain groups of people in this country are making big money on this thing.
Always have.
I would like
the profession. Yeah.
I'll make one comment there. It's in line with what's been said earlier about being grandparents. You can also be your godparents to a child that's baptized.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have an influence on that child. I'm not saying you're going to, but that the possibility remains. And sometimes you can set a standard for them to reach towards that possibly they aren't getting from where they should be. And it comes, we say we'll see to it that they get religious instruction, the Bible will be in their hand. But part of that religious instruction is how we relate to them as people.
Mm-hmm. Do so believe. Well, it's worth indeed talking about, is indeed worth praying about, and I would hope that it's worth doing something about. Again, what Holden hopes is that you influence also congregations back home. And if you don't sit around talking about some of the things that we talk about here, we think you ought to. And one of those is grief and grieving, that I'm in the midst of now. Often I think it's such a jolt to a congregation as if they didn't know anybody was going to die, ever. And we have very little preparation for the grieving process. Some isolated congregations have groups that get together and talk about that, both for those who are grieving and those who will be grieving. But also in this area of sexuality is one that I think there ought to be some open discussion on it, and so that parents can say things to one another, kids can say things back and forth, and it can be treated seriously. I don't think we should ever stop laughing at the jokes, because I think intercourse by itself is one of God's great jokes. The whole manipulation of that thing is just funny. If you can picture a scene for yourself. But we don't have to stop laughing, because we laugh and cry at the things that are most serious. Don't stop laughing or crying about it, but also that it can be seriously discussed as it relates to the way we act as Christian persons, as baptized people, expressing our baptized sexuality for other people. I think that's a goal worth working on. I'm glad you came to the session. Thank you.